Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Jeff Weaver, who grew up in a tiny Vermont town near the Canadian border, became a household name, at least in politics, in 2016 as a campaign manager for his old friend and client, Bernie Sanders. He's written a book about that experience called How Bernie Won, Inside the Revolution That's Taken Back Our Country, and Where We Go From Here. And where he goes from here and where Bernie Sanders goes from here was one of the things we talked about when he came by the Institute of Politics last week and sat down with me. Jeff Weaver, welcome here and welcome to the Institute of Politics. It's good to see you again. You come from as probably as close to being in Canada as one can come. Tell me about St. Albans, Vermont.
Yeah, so St. Albans, Vermont, well, it's changed a lot since I was a kid. It's was a conservative Democratic area, had more cows than people. I went to high school with a substantial number of people who spoke French at home as their first language.
And your folks were
French Canadian. Absolutely, absolutely. My mother's maiden name is Champagne.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's how good. That's how French Canadian it is. So yeah, you know, in those days the border was, you know, we talk about open borders these days. When I grew up, the border with Quebec was basically an open border. You could drive back and forth, being waved through. So there was a lot more interaction across the border than there is now, certainly. But
and your dad ran a pet shop there?
My dad had a pet shop. He did a bunch of jobs, but his final job in life was having a pet store in St. Albans, which he loved very much. He worked for many years at a utility as a late night. The person you called when your power went out, he would dispatch the trucks for folks. So it was a nice place to grow up. I mean, it was obviously homogenous in some ways. There were two Catholic churches. It was an Irish Catholic church on the hill and a French Catholic church below the
tracks. So it was diverse.
It was diverse. That's right. We had Irish Catholics and French Catholics. And, you know, the major minority was Methodists.
And I read somewhere that years later when you were working with Bernie Sanders, he was in your town and fielding a press call or something in your dad's pet shop while the cockatoos were holding
forth. Screaming. You know, those days there was no cell phone. So when you wanted to call somebody, you had to find a telephone. So we went to my father's pet store and he had this giant, very beautiful cockatoo. And it was screaming in the background. And the AP reporter in Montpelier, the capital, said, Bernie, where are you? It sounds like you're in the jungle somewhere. Yeah. I also remember driving with Bernie from one town to another late for a live radio show. And we were desperately looking for a payphone as the host is on the air saying, I don't know where Mayor Sanders is. Where could he be? You know, no cell phone. Just a very different world in those days.
Yeah, I'll say. And I'm sure there are days when he probably misses those days.
Yeah.
Every politician of a certain age probably does. There was a kind of charm to that when you had a few moments to collect your thoughts before being thrown in the maelstrom.
No, that's right. I mean, now you get in the car and it's just another period of work, right? There's phone calls and, as you know, sometimes multiple cell phones being passed to a candidate back and forth, and there just is no sort of downtime to write or think or get your bearings.
Now, were you deeply interested in politics as a kid?
I was not deeply interested in politics as a kid. I was interested in sort of political theory as a kid. I became sort of politicized when I was at Boston University in undergraduate school. I became involved first in the Soviet Jewry movement and then in the anti-apartheid movement.
Why in the Soviet Jewry movement?
I was a Russian area studies major at the time, and I had met You know, there were a number of Jewish students at BU, and I became involved. I was convinced to go down to an annual lobby they had in D.C. at that time to lobby members of Congress on behalf of Soviet Jewry. And I had a geography professor who heard I was going, and she said, "I have a friend I would like you to meet." And I met this woman, and her mother was still in the Soviet Union, and they weren't letting her leave. And I brought her case actually to Pat Leahy, Vermont
Your senator.
Exactly. And he raised it with Soviet officials, and she was ultimately released. It was sort of early
That's
example
gratifying.
To me of political activism paying off. And then I was arrested in anti-apartheid protests at BU and unceremoniously asked to leave. And that's when I met up with Bernie Sanders in the summer of
1986. You set up shanty towns.
We did. Other
on
schools,
campus.
Other schools were doing it. It seemed to go fine. At BU, that was John Silber. I don't know if you remember John Silber.
Yeah, I do. Who went on to
notorious.
A career in politics. Yes.
Yes, notorious right-winger. Anyway, he was not going to tolerate that, and we were...
Well, there was and also you hung banners out of your...
I did. They tried to throw us out of the dorms. The Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts represented us in court, and we won that case. And they said there was no institution in Massachusetts that had more civil rights violations or civil liberties violations lodged against it than the Boston University under John Silber at that time.
Why did the anti-apartheid movement so seize you, so much so that you... cost you your place there.
It was such a clear and compelling example of injustice in the world. You know, here you had just a brutal regime that was keeping down the vast majority of people in that country, obviously along racial lines. And, you know, Boston University, John Silber was a big fan of Ronald Reagan. You know, he was bringing speakers, you know, you wouldn't call them pro-apartheid speakers, but there were certainly apologists for apartheid speakers onto campus. And it just moved me very much that an institution that I was paying a lot of money to was involved in supporting that regime. You know, and BU had, at that time, there were a number of departments. The International Relations Department had strong relationships with the Contra rebels in Central America. There was eventually a scandal at the communication school involving the CIA sending students there to be trained as journalists and then sending them to foreign countries to join news organizations and report back, you know, stuff on the AP and the UPI and others. So, you know, BU at that point was really sort of had become a sort of hub of far-right intelligentsia and was being used in that way to build credibility for people who would then support that kind of agenda around the world. And it was very disturbing.
One of the ways you cleansed yourself was to go back and work for a socialist mayor of yes, Burlington running for governor.
Yeah, running for governor at that time, right, as an independent against Madeleine Cunin, who was in the middle of her first two-year term when Bernie announced. And for the record, Madeleine Cunin was one of the few Democrats in Vermont in 2016 who supported Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, which was a small minority of people. Vermont is the only state during the primary process where a candidate swept all of the delegates. So that was certainly a minority position in Vermont.
But back in 86, what was it that drew you to Bernie?
Well, I had been quote unquote radicalized at undergraduate school, and I came back home again to this sort of sleepy place, and I was looking for, you know, what am I going to do now? I'm kicked out of college, right? I don't have a job. And you know, he was running, and I called down to his office to see if I could help out, and a guy named Phil Fermonti came up, who has been a friend of mine now for decades, came up, and then should have been my first warning, David. By the time he left my house, I was the county coordinator for a gubernatorial campaign with absolutely no political experience whatsoever. It seemed good at the time, but in hindsight, it should have been a warning.
See, I don't know about him, but this cockatoo seems pretty
yeah,
sharp.
Yeah, right, so. Exactly. So I met Bernie at an event when he came. I staffed him at an event he came up to in Franklin County. And, you know, I guess we hit it off, and he called me up and said, can you come down and work in Burlington a couple of days a week? And it's been, I don't know, how many years is that now? 30 years since then.
How, which is the greatest thing in politics is when you have these long-term relationships where of trust, where you really know how someone thinks. And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
What was it then? What What do you recall about your initial interactions with him? I mean, I will tell you that the impression of him generally is that he believes deeply in what he believes.
Yes.
And completely sincerely doesn't have a whole lot of time for kind of social niceties. He's got more important things on his mind.
Right.
And I assume he was like that then.
Yeah, he was. And, in some ways, you know, we were going around the state and he was, you know, he would meet with small groups of people, 8-10 people, you know, far cry from the 30,000, you know, person crowds he had in 2016. But, you know, in some ways there were similarities because at that point he was mayor of Burlington, not that well known or understood.
And that itself was a national story when he won
absolutely.
That race.
Absolutely.
Because he was clearly on the left. He ran, came out of nowhere, you know.
Yeah, he knocked off a machine, you know, machine politician in Burlington. But outside the Burlington, you know, Burlington, in Vermont, Burlington, you look at it as a small city, but in Vermont, Burlington's the big city, right?
Yes.
And so among rural people and small town people, Burlington is looked at, was looked at as sort of like the big city. And so people didn't know really what to make of him outside of Burlington. So he had a lot of work to do. The truth of the matter is he ended up being very, very popular with rural people in particular, I think, who appreciated his sincerity and understood that he was, you know, believe what he said.
You know, let me ask you a question about that, because he did my very first Axe Files 277 shows ago. And,
well, who's counting, David?
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a little meter on my desk. And one of the things I talked to him about was guns. And I asked him, and I actually really appreciated his candor. I said, if you were representing Brooklyn, where you grew up, rather than Vermont, would your position have been different on guns? Because he had been, you know, sort of moderate on the issue, and he said probably so.
Yeah. Although I got to tell you, in Vermont, you know, his position in Vermont, particularly in the 80s when he was running for first, trying to run for Congress, you know, was really very, considered very extremely left. You know, Howard Dean had an A-plus rating from the NRA throughout his entire career. He would never have touched guns with a 10-foot pole. And Bernie in 88, when he ran for Congress and lost by 3 points, you know, he was the only, again, running as an independent, both the Democrat and Republican both pledged that they would not ban assault weapons. And he said, no, I will ban assault weapons in 1988. And so, you know, there's the course of a presidential campaign, there's a lot of nuance that gets lost, as you well know, as people try to paint you with broad brushstrokes. But the truth of the matter is that in Vermont, certainly Bernie was way out front in terms of the assault weapons ban ahead of everybody.
Yeah,
else.
I mean, there are other issues. I'm not prosecuting him. I'm really making another point,
which is
that he, you know, you are elected to represent your state, and plainly the fact that the state, there was a large rural population, lots of hunters and so on.
Right.
He clearly talked to folks about that. That informed somebody. He had a nuanced position on the issue. The thing is that in the times in which we live, it's hard to have a nuanced position on that issue.
Well, I mean, you know, apropos of like where I grew up, you know, in many people's homes, you will go into the living room, and one of the major sort of pieces of furniture is a glass gun case,
which has
five or six guns in it. There's the ammunition is lying on the shelf below. And no one thinks anything about it. Nor would anybody think that that would be something that you would take and use for some nefarious purpose. It's just one of the things you have.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing that's so difficult is how do we have a reasoned discussion on this? You know, Obama had a debate when he was in the state Senate with a rural legislator, and he said, you know, I know, and I think I've said this here before, but I know that, you know, you grew up with guns and, you know, your dad took you out at dawn hunting and his dad did the same.
Right.
And this, you know, big part of your life and of your, of what is typical in your communities. In my community, though, I've got parents who wait by the window anxiously, hoping that their kids don't get shot on the way home. And he said there has to be a way to protect your traditions and art and the children in my area. And he's right about that. And we ought to be able to have, but we can't. We can't because of, frankly, because of the way the issue has been weaponized. And here, you know, I'm sure people, because it has, people who, if there are people listening on the right here, they would say, well, weaponized by gun control advocates. But really, the NRA is kind of an industry now.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they speak for an industry. I mean, they're really, you know, they have weaponized this issue on behalf of the gun industry,
right,
and shrouded it in intimations about autocracy and the overweening government and
let's be clear. I mean, the NRA has become, you know, an adjunct to the Republican Party. It is a wildly partisan organization. I mean, I remember when Bernie first got elected to the House of Representatives, there were a lot of many more rural Democrats, right? And their views on gun legislation within the Democratic Party was much more diverse in terms of positioning, and it was much more urban-rural. Now it's completely a partisan issue, right? And Republicans, you know, use it to try to beat up Democrats.
It's interesting to see how this, if and how this issue evolves. It feels like that Parkland shooting was a bit of a watershed. We'll see how, certainly in suburban areas, the issue has changed, but so have suburban voters.
Yes.
So you ultimately did go back to college at the University of Vermont.
I did, yes. Between campaigns, Bernie, I worked with Bernie in 86, where he was not successful in running for governor. I worked with him in 88, he ran for Congress and lost by 3 points. And then in 90, he came back and had a sort of rerun against the Republican who had beaten him 2 years earlier, and he won in 1990. And then I came down to D.C. with him.
Yeah, it says a lot about your relationship that you lost all these races and he still wanted you back.
Yeah, right. Well, I wasn't, those campaigns were, very different than what I understand now, like a modern,
yes,
a modern campaign. They were very, Bernie did a lot of the quote-unquote running of the campaign. It was very few people. The amount of money was, when I look back on it, like very, very little. Although we ran TV advertising, certainly in 88 and 90.
Probably not that expensive in Vermont.
Not that expensive. Yeah. And I'm sure the ads were homemade. And so there was no production expense or very little. So it was,
not a lot of money on makeup and wardrobe.
No, exactly. Hair.
Yeah, but so you went down, and you also you attended law school. Did you do that after you went down there?
I did. I don't tell people at Georgetown because they tell you can't work while you're going into the first year of law school. But
too late now.
I would work on the hill. You're right. I would work on the hill, and Georgetown Law School is on Capitol Hill, so I would leave the hill to go to class and then go back to the hill. So I did.
It was okay with Bernie.
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, yes, I just went, class time isn't that much. You have to cram your studying in at night. After my second year, I did a summer, sort of traditional summer associate gig at a firm. And then I left Bernie's office and worked at that firm for 3 years.
You left out one significant part of your biography, which is your own brief campaign as a candidate.
I was actually a candidate twice. I ran for alderman
in St. Albans
in the most conservative ward in the city in a three-year race. Didn't do well. And then I ran for mayor of that city,
following in the footsteps of the man himself.
Well, that's what my opponents were saying. Yeah. And I got almost 40% of the vote. My opponent had the endorsement of both parties. I was 24. I won the sort of working class side of the city barely, and then in the hill section, I was, slaughtered. It was an interesting lesson in class politics, even in a place like that.
Yeah, didn't leave you with the bug to want to ever do it again.
No, not really. I've done that, and I much prefer the role I have now. You know, there's plenty of great people running for office. And, you know, frankly, David, as you know, in many ways, the environment is so toxic. I don't understand how anybody runs for office, frankly.
Yeah. Is that what you're saying to Bernie when he's deciding whether to run in
2020? No, look, I'm very clear. But the last three words of my book are "Run, Bernie, run." So I'm very clear about what I think he should do. But you know, it's ultimately his decision.
I don't want to leap ahead because I want to follow your own story here. But on that subject, because you raised it, politics is so coarse today and so difficult. And what is it about him that he seems, there were times when he got irascible
occasionally,
and reacted when he was attacked and so on. But generally he seems to take the incoming, and he seems, you know, to keep on heading forward. What is it about him that allows him to endure the environment?
Yeah, he's always had, this goes way back from the early days, he's always had the conviction that if he can just talk to enough people about his ideas and the policy agenda that he's advocating, that he'll be successful. And this is true in the presidential race, you know, when he would count the number of, we go to Iowa and he would hold rallies, and he kept a rolling track of how many actual people attended the rallies, just because he wanted to know what percent of the eventual electorate he actually talked to basically in person, right? And he was always very, you know, some of us would make the case, well, many more people will see part of this rally on television than in person. And he's like, no, I don't care about that. I want to know how many actual people I'm talking to. So he's always had that. And so he keeps his head, keeps his head down. He puts his shoulder harder into the wheel, and he tries to talk to more people about the sort of vision he articulates. And he's confident that if he can, again, do that to enough with enough people, he'll be successful.
There were they came in oblique ways, but stories written, attacks that were probably propagated by people who wanted to stop him about his wife and her tenure as head of Burlington College and so on. That must have been difficult.
Yeah, no, clearly it was. And yes, they were propagated. I mean, you know, the chief propagator was Trump's campaign manager in Vermont. So, I mean, I don't think it's any, but that'll come as a surprise to anybody. But yeah, it's very difficult. You've been with a candidate too. When their family gets attacked or they get attacked in an unfair way, particularly when you go after their family, you know, it really hurts. I mean, even look like, you know, Ted Cruz, when his father was accused of being, you know, one of the Kennedy assassins or...
Chris, he's gotten over it. He loves President Trump now.
Apparently they've kissed and made up. Yes. But you know, you've been in the heat of a campaign, and when family members get attacked, it's
yeah. And I find it, really distasteful. You know, it's one of the things that really bothered me was, you know, I think you and I may have a different view on this. I get beaten up by the left on this all the time. I don't like chasing people into restaurants when they're there with their family. There have to be some, you know, you've been a practitioner of politics for a long time. You've worked with an elected official. You know, because my feeling is once you knock norms down, this is my objection to the president, once you shred what used to be norms, you know, like there are zones beyond which, you know, then you never get them back. And if the left can chase Sarah Sanders or someone else into a restaurant and chase their family out, the right's going to do the same thing. And we're in this mad cycle of, you know, and I'm not sure it contributes anything to me, it's more an act of frustration than something constructive, you know, and I understand the frustration, but.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at the end of the day that you have to beat them at the ballot box. I mean, that's how you are vindicated in politics in a democracy, is beating them at the ballot box. I mean, you know, apropos of the sort of norms, you know, I remember, God, how many years ago was it now? I was at a Christmas mass, and the priest, who had a thick Irish brogue, I mean, he was like right from Ireland, you know, spoke against the war. And a fully dressed, fully uniformed Virginia state policeman walked to the front of the church and sort of scolded him and then walked out. Like that's, you know, that so it works both ways.
Yes,
you know what
of
I mean?
Course, yeah.
And to see a sort of policeman in a, you know, in the Virginia uniform is fairly military looking, you know, scolding a cleric for talking against the war. I mean, you know, that's I think what you're talking about, this sort of breakdown.
Well, we get into, it's a mad cycle down, you know,
right.
Where one thing begets another thing and you wonder where it all leads. And I thoroughly, thoroughly agree with you. I mean, I'm a believer. I wrote a book called Believer. I'm a believer. And it wasn't about a person. It was about this idea of democracy, and there is one self-correcting, there's one corrective in a democracy, and that is the vote.
Right.
And
but you know, David, but that's been weaponized too. I mean, you know, Republicans, as you know, working very hard because they don't want to compete fairly at the ballot box, and so they do things to. You know,
well,
to make it harder for people to vote,
and
right?
That, I mean, and that, to me, is an absolutely important battle to fight. I mean, my view is that we should want every single person
absolutely
to participate in elections, and we shouldn't game the system in any way. And anyone who does should be prevented from doing that. And I agree with you. I mean, I think if you feel like you are if you feel like you are advantaged if fewer people vote, that could be a sign that you shouldn't win.
Right.
You know. So you stuck with Bernie Sanders throughout his time in the House, and you ran his campaign for the Senate.
Yeah, right. So I left. I worked the law firm for a few years. And then he called me back, and I was his House Chief of Staff for a number of years. And then, in 2000.
What kind of law did you practice in those 2 years?
So I did government contracts law. So I worked for an illustrious number of government contractors in their never-ending pushing money back and forth across the table with the government. So United Technologies and companies like that. It was actually, it was an important moment for me because I really got to see sort of how corporate America works and what the structures
and
what are like
you
and
learned.
The culture. Well, just the way information's passed, the culture of how big corporations work. I mean, I just think I think too few people on the left understand that world at all, right? Mm-hmm. They have conceptions about it. In some ways, it's much less nefarious than people think. You know, it's collections of people trying to make a lot of money, and you know, people will do things at times that are like in any other endeavor that are not appropriate in order to achieve their end, but. But it was an interesting window for me, coming from my small town and working for the, congressman from Vermont.
Yeah, you worked with him. You ran the campaign.
Yeah, we had a self-funded opponent in 2006. A guy who just sold his company. He had built a medical software company. He had sold it, and he had hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, in cash in his bank account, and the most that anyone had ever spent in a Senate race in Vermont. This is going to sound quaint to people who are familiar with politics. Was Pat Leahy had spent $2 million in the prior election cycle. So
it's lunch money today.
Yeah, right. $2 million to run a Senate race. So, but for us that was a lot of money. And at the end of the day, our opponent ended up spending $8 million, and we spent over $6 million. Most of it raised through direct mail. This is before the advent of internet fundraising to a large extent.
And how much of it came from Vermont?
I'm sure a relatively small, relatively small part.
Vermont is not a huge fundraising.
No, right. I mean, we had a lot of. I mean, in terms of donations, we had a lot of Vermont donations, but they would have relatively small donations compared to what you would get nationally.
And then you. I have to ask you about your foray into the comic book business.
Yeah.
Do you still have your store?
I do still have my store. In fact, last weekend I was at the New York Comic Con. It's quite a place.
So tell me about this fascination. I have to tell you, I had it once in my possession when I was a kid. Almost every inaugural issue of Marvel, Thor and Spider-Man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had the most extraordinary collection of comic books. I vent about this every once in a while. I also had a great collection of baseball cards and autographs, like Jackie Robinson.
Yeah, right.
I mean, just, and I made the mistake of not securing them before I went to college, and my mother wanted to reclaim my room and just threw it out, thinking this.
Well, you're not. This is not an uncommon story, as you know, David.
Yeah, I know, but it's one that sticks in my craw. I'll tell you that. But how much would the first edition of Spider-Man yield today?
So the first appearance of Spider-Man, sort of on the, you know, it's that hobby, it's very grade driven, right? The nicer the book is, the more it brings. But you know, so the range on that book would be anywhere from $15,000 to $2 million. Depending on the condition.
All right.
Yours is probably your
red. Now, let me just
say,
the reason I want to have this discussion is, even though she's slipped her earthly bonds, I still have this notion that my mom knows what I'm doing.
Right.
And if she's listening to this podcast, Mom, do you hear that? Do you hear what you threw out? But anyway, so tell me
It wasn't worth that then.
I loved it, though, man. I was a voracious reader of comic books. I remember there was a blackout in New York in 1966, and so school, you know, there was going to be no school the next day. And a friend of mine and I went into the staircase of my, I lived in a housing project, a housing development in New York, and we just took flashlights and just read comic books for hours.
I was a voracious comic book reader as a kid too. So was Bernie, by the way, you should know.
Is that right?
He tells you stories about he and his brother would and friends of theirs would trade comic books. You know, he was living obviously in Brooklyn, but you know, I was in Vermont in a small place, and it was really a way to. I mean, it was really an escape, right?
Yeah.
This is before 24-hour TV, and the you know, people don't remember the days of the. You know, the staticky late night television, the planes flying, the national anthem, and like, you know, there was, you know, three TV stations, and
yeah.
It was just a different, like now there's so much entertainment on your phone or on the big screen or whatever, but there were, you know, comic books for quite a few generations were a major form of escapist entertainment.
And did you have, I was kind of like a Marvel and a DC.
Yeah, I was too. I was too. So I decided after spending a couple of years as the Senate chief of staff that I was just done with politics. And so
why?
Because you get tired of it after a while, David. It's tough, right? You know, I ran the Senate campaign. I went to, you know, was in Vermont for 6 months. I went Monday through Friday to Vermont. I had little kids.
Back in D.C.
Yeah, right, in Northern Virginia. Yeah, so I just wanted to do something else. And so I thought I would do that. And my daughter runs the store now. So I didn't
want to. Nice family business.
Yeah, it's been successful. I don't know that it's a business that I can pass on to them ultimately, if the interest will still be there in the world for comic books.
But it's a profit making venture.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have seven employees.
Uh huh. And is that. I know that you have this side gig, which is looking after. The Sanders,
well, that's really my primary gig. The comic book business is the side.
You're just saying that
gig.
Because you think Bernie may hear the podcast.
It's the side gig now, but I was happily there until I got the call in, you know, 2015.
Yeah, let's talk about that. You know, I remember when he decided that he was going to run. Not a whole lot of people took that very seriously. I mean, I remember from my own time in the Senate, I remember going to the Senate caucus. He always was sitting by himself. You know, Bernie Sanders was a solitary figure, and he had issues that he raised that others weren't raising and so on. But nobody really thought of him. You wouldn't look around and see this kind of rumpled, wild-haired guy sitting by himself and say, this is the guy in the room who's going to be president of the United States.
It's going to excite the millennial generation.
Exactly. Yes. Tell me about that process of deciding that he was going to run.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you, like Chronicle is my book. He called me up for a meeting, and, you know, as you point out, Bernie's, you know, very focused on his work and like social niceties. So like when I work with him, I, you know, we talk every day and often multiple meet and so on and so forth. But when you're not working with him, even if you were.
He's not saying coming over and have a beer.
Yeah. There's not like a lot of.
Coming over and have a bowl of Ben and Jerry's. He doesn't say that.
Right. I mean, you know, I would get invited to the holiday party and I would go to that. But other than that, you didn't really hear from him much. So I got a call from him out of the blue asking if I wanted to have dinner. So we went and had dinner at Union Station. And it was just all chit-chat, right? Like, how are you doing? How are your kids doing? I was helping coach my kids' little league teams. How's your store doing? And, like, you know, just like if I, you know, I went out to dinner at some point, you're like, you're done sort of talking and people go home. And I went home and my wife said, what did he want? And I was like, I have no idea. This is before he, you know, but this is not, clearly he wanted something. And then, you know, it became clear after watching news, you know, he did this tour around the country, this sort of like pre-tour, went to Iowa and a few places. So it became clear that he was thinking about running for president. And then he called me up again and we went to dinner again. This was right before he announced, the day before he announced. And I said, are we going to talk about today what we were supposed to talk about last time? And I, you know, I just think.
Why didn't he talk to you about it?
He was trying to gauge how good my life was and whether he should say. You should throw all that away and.
Well, like, you must have been pretty persuasive since he didn't raise the subject.
Right. I know.
Business is fantastic.
I had a very good life. And so he explained to me that he was going to run for president. We talked about sort of his thinking about what he wanted it to be like. You know, at that point, he'd already talked to a number of consultants, you know, not a pollster at that time. We didn't have a pollster till the fall, but, you know, the TV guys and the digital guys and. You know, it all seemed very expensive to him, which it is, as you know, very expensive. And, you know, I think on some level he wanted somebody to help
sort all of that
out. Yeah, and like somebody he was clearly in his corner, right?
Make sure he didn't get ripped off.
Right, and that things were done the way he wanted them done, that he wasn't, you know, consumed by consultants' view of what he should be or say, right? He's always been super resistant to that, which is one of his...
Right, appeals.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, he certainly understood the value that, you know, people can raise money online or people that can run a social media campaign or people that can create TV commercials or people that, you know, and ultimately people that can poll. You know, he understands the value of these things, but he doesn't want to be consumed by them, right?
And so, so he finally put his cards on the table and said, will you do this?
Yes, and we talked. You know, we talked about, and I might be the only one, probably maybe even more than he was, convinced that not that he would win, but that he could win, because I had just seen it in Vermont, and you know, people have a view of him, and it's, you know, it's largely a stereotypical view at this point about who he appeals to and, you know, how people relate to him. But you know, I saw, you know, rural people, otherwise Republican. Rural people who love Bernie Sanders. I mean, I remember very distinctly, he and I went to a Strawberry Festival at St. Anne Shrine in the islands in Lake Champlain. And we went to the cafeteria. This was running for governor, I think, very early on. And we were in a cafeteria, and there were a bunch of French-Canadian ladies there. I mean, they were Vermonters, but French-Canadian heritage, looked like my grandmother. Behind the counter, you know, with like the Jell-O and the, you know, the metal bars, you run your tray down. And they were literally, David, crawling through the food to get to Bernie Sanders. And this is very early on. And so he has always had this connection with rural people that I think people just don't understand. And you saw in the primaries, you know, and I've talked to, you know, I have great relations with a lot of the senior Hillary people now, having worked with them in the general election. And they didn't get it either until later in the campaign that, in fact, Bernie Sanders was going to do well with rural Democrats, with quote-unquote moderate Democrats. He did much better with those voters than Hillary Clinton did, right? And you know, they were at one point trying to drive those voters out to counter him, and in fact, they were helping him.
You know, so let's dive in for a second into that appeal. I mean, there's a lot been made of sort of the fact that Trump energized these rural voters, that Sanders energized these rural voters, that there were some populist themes in common on trade, for example. How much of what evolved in that campaign was about him, and how much was it about Hillary, who, for all her strengths, was true in 2008 as well, really kind of an avatar of the status quo, a very well-established Washington figure who was associated with the establishment in Washington in every conceivable way.
Right. Look, elections are binary. So particularly, we have a two-person race, it's a choice, obviously.
With apologies to Governor O'Malley, yes.
Yeah, right. Well, it became binary very quickly. I mean, just like in 2008, I mean, John Edwards did not play the role in that race that he played in 2004, where he was one of the top two people.
But we had, that field was, people forget it was Joe Biden and Chris Dodd and Bill Richardson. And there were other, serious people in that race. That field, it was advantageous to be in a binary race.
Yes. No, that's exactly right. And Barack Obama was certainly the outsider yes. candidate in that primary. There's no doubt about that. But I do think that there is a lot of discontent in the country. There's a lot of anxiety in the country. I think it's largely economic, but manifests itself in other ways. And I think that the Clinton people didn't sort of get that in 2016. I think a lot of the policy people she had around her were very much more conservative. I mean conservative and cautious.
Incremental in there.
Yeah, and I think that they had to suddenly Bernie caught on, and they really tried to catch up. Right. I mean, she was not for a $15 minimum wage until she got to New York. Then she was for it. There was like an evolution in her policy prescription. They kept getting more and more left to try to catch up where the party was.
That was problematical as well, because inauthenticity was one of the charges
that
stuck.
Yes.
And so if you try and change in order to catch up, you're also opening yourself up to even more questions about what you actually feel strongly about.
No, that's right. Look, the polling was, like at the very beginning of the race, the polling was, at least that I saw, was pretty clear that Hillary Clinton was very popular with self-identified Democrats. I mean, her popularity was very high. Obama was slightly higher, but, he's beloved by Democrats. But she had a real problem. This is before any engagement with Bernie. She had a problem with younger voters, and she had a problem with independent voters. And as you know, in most places in this country, independent voters can participate in the Democratic primary process. And her favorables, when you got to a democratically leaning independent, they weren't like off a cliff. There's been a lot of talk about would Bernie have won or not won. And obviously the Clinton people say, well, he would have had all these attacks against him, and that she already had these attacks against her. But they had landed on her, and she was carrying that baggage, and it had really hurt her with independent voters. And in a general election, as you know, that's a big, what are you going to tell independent voters who have a fixed notion of you from decades that's going to change their mind, right? When you start with high negatives with independent voters, it's a real challenge.
There are, everybody has their view in hindsight. There are people who are close to her who would say, you guys cost her the general because the primary was so vituperative, so difficult, so lengthy, so costly. I know you guys were helpful to her in the general. As you point out, you work with them in the general. But what do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that is just 100% wrong, frankly. I mean, if you look at the tone and tenor of that 2016 race compared to 2008, it was a much tamer exchange than in 2008, frankly. And I always look back to, I actually believe in long primaries. I think it actually benefits Democrats. Media only likes to cover conflict. And as soon as the conflict goes away, the coverage goes away.
In 2008, we wanted to end it early.
Right.
Nobody really wants to go through a long primary. I came to believe that people wanted to see Obama run the full course because he was a young guy and not a lot of Washington experience. So they were testing him, but it also was true that from an organizational standpoint, having to run races in 50 states created forward momentum in those states and organizations, so on, that was good. And the race dominated, you know, McCain, John McCain was the candidate in 2008 for the Republicans. Couldn't break into the story because everyone was focused on the Democratic race.
Well, and you look at 2004 when Edwards leaves the race in April, like the media coverage of Kerry just goes away until the convention. And then the next thing you know, he's being swift boated in August. Meanwhile, the Republican administration, I was on the Hill then, they would trot out a cabinet secretary or high-level government official literally on the hour and dominate the news for the entire, you know, Kerry could not break through. But that was because the primary was over, the quote-unquote conflict was gone, and the media went away.
I guess the essence of the suggestion they're making is some of the themes that you guys developed against her in the primaries became themes that Trump picked up on. And in fact, Trump loved to quote Bernie Sanders against her, mischievous. I guess that's a benign way of saying
it. That is benign.
But so there is that. You guys opened up some wounds that were hard to heal.
I'm not sure that those wounds weren't there before the campaign started. I mean, as I pointed out, you know, the independent voters had difficulty with Hillary Clinton before the campaign was even engaged, and it was largely on the issue of trustworthiness. That was something that they came to the election with. That was not something that was created by our campaign. And frankly, David,
there moments when you talked to before you had many debates? Some of them were pretty. There were some pretty sharp exchanges.
New York was probably the sharpest.
I remember it well.
We were on the ropes. We had to do well in New York, which we did not do.
And what kind of conversations did you have about how far he was willing to go?
Yeah, well, he was, you know, so for instance, you know, he did not go after the foundation, right? That would have been clearly something that somebody could have gone after. He didn't want to go there. You remember he famously said in November at the Las Vegas,
tired
the first
of the
one,
damn email.
Tired of the damn emails. But the point being, it's dominating the conversation. Let's talk about, he wanted to talk about single-payer health care. He wanted to talk about the $15 minimum wage, climate change. He wanted to talk about these issues.
That probably, though, was a very big moment for him when he said that,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes.
Because it was unlike what people expect from politicians, not to jump in on an opportunity like that.
Right. And he, you know, I mean, he doesn't go after people's personalities or their personal life. It's just he's not interested in that kind of politics. He always wants to, you know, if he had won, he would have wanted to have won on the basis of the ideas that he was putting forward so that he would have in some way a mandate to push those ideas through. Because it's not, it's not personal for him. As he often tells me, he goes, look, you know where I come from. I wasn't somebody who was born and groomed to be president of the United States. I don't have to be president of the United States. And that's absolutely true. He's not somebody who's, you know, was groomed from a child to be the next leader of the free world. That's not who he is.
Not back in Brooklyn, they weren't.
There, nobody when said, he was training
in
Superman
Madison
comics
High School
brother,
in Brooklyn, right. They didn't say, hey, that guy looks like he could be president of the United States.
Exactly.
Hey, did you yourself had some pretty, you were a fierce advocate for your guy, and you had some really big rows, particularly about the process itself and what you felt was the stacking of the process against him. And I assume to this day you feel that way. I think you've written about it. And you know,
absolutely. I mean, yeah. It was, well, we know Donna Brazile exposed that in the summer of 2015, you know, there's a document between Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Clinton campaign essentially giving them control over staffing and messaging. And that was certainly not something that was revealed during the campaign. But there were enough other things. It's clear that the Clinton campaign dictated the debate schedule, including where and when and how many there would be. That was dictated by them. Tom Perez, I think, is in a much different position. I think he will be, regardless of who's the candidate, will be a much honest broker. I mean, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you know, you remember the point at which she shut off our data because a couple of low-level staffers, you know, took advantage of a breach in the firewall. I mean, you know.
Well, the charge was that you guys had stolen data from campaign.
Which the subsequent investigation demonstrated, you know, which we paid for, showed by a contractor picked by the DNC, there was no data stolen. You know, it was modeling data. You would have had to memorize, you know, 10,000 person lists in the course of 30 or 40 seconds in order to have had data taken.
You should answer. I didn't ask you when you brought it up before. Do you think he would have beaten? Do you think Bernie Sanders would have beaten Donald Trump?
Oh, absolutely. I do think he would have beaten Trump. And because he would not, you know, if you look at, you know, you look at Michigan, Hillary Clinton lost Michigan in the primary. She lost in the general election in exactly the same way. You know, there was depressed turnout in Detroit and Wayne County, and then overwhelming turnout against her everywhere else, small towns, rural areas, suburbs. And he it was an identity. You know, Bernie Sanders would not have lost Michigan, would not have lost Wisconsin,
you know, interesting
would not
thing
have lost
about
Pennsylvania.
That, Jeff, I hear you, and I don't know the answer to the question really, but she kind of cleaned his clock among African American voters in the primary. So why do you think they'd be more enthusiastic about him in the general?
Well, that's not so. That's the narrative, right? And early in the campaign, that was true. By the time we get to Michigan, he's going toe-to-toe with her with African-American voters under 40. By the time we get to Pennsylvania, when the campaign, in fact, is tanking, basically our campaign after New York started a steady decline, he was doing better than she was with African-Americans under 40. We only lost the African-American vote in Pennsylvania by 10 points. I think we lost the overall state by more, so we're doing better with black voters.
Because African-American voters under 40 are not a majority of African-American voters.
No, well, that's right. But, you know, this was an issue throughout the campaign, David. If you look at voters over 60
no, I was watching
of any
it
race,
time,
it doesn't, it was, that was not, you know, what is true is that, according to the exit polls, the percentage of African-American voters who are millennials is much smaller than in other communities. So in the exit polls, it was 12% of African-American voters were millennials. In the non-African-American community in Democratic primaries, it was 18%. Mm. And so that, you know, made us look like we were doing even worse with African-American mm-hmm. voters. But it was primarily, it had a lot to do with the age of the electorate and not the race of the electorate. But I will admit that it, you know, certainly in the South at the beginning.
It was crucial. It was. You know, this is important because you and I were talking before we started rolling about the fact that there are a lot of people who aren't run for president who talk about it as if it's, you know, like The Voice or something, and you just kind of right. perform and then everybody right. votes. It's a process.
Yes.
And it begins in Iowa, and you have to, and New Hampshire. You know, you've got Nevada and then South Carolina, where the right. vote is a majority African-American vote in the primary. And the question is, and even now with the California primary, now it's been moved back, so early voting will begin on the day of the Iowa caucuses. You have to figure out how you're going to navigate this, because if you don't, you know, there's not going to be a binary choice in 2020. Right. This is like, you know, they're going to be
the multitudes.
They're going to have, yes, it's going to be. I mean, it's easier to list the number of Democrats who aren't thinking of running right. for president than those who are. So only a few are going to come through that funnel. That is Iowa, New Hampshire, and if you do survive, it then becomes really important how you can compete with African American voters who
Absolutely.
Have disproportionate impact on some of these primaries, South Carolina, Super Tuesday primaries, these Southern primaries, and the cost of it. How much do you think it'll cost a candidate to just run the first four races, you know, run through the South Carolina primary into Super Tuesday this time?
Well, as you point out, you know, California will start voting when Iowa's voting. So you have to be advertising even you have to, you know, you have to be a couple weeks early even there.
Which
so,
is enormously
Yeah, well, so that's expensive. 50 million. I mean, if you want to do a full flight of 6 weeks of TV in California, what are you talking about? $50 million,
yes.
right?
Yes.
No, Iowa, it's probably 16 million, you know, New Hampshire, because of your advertising
Boston
out of
media
Boston media market is another, it's probably similar. You know, Nevada's cheaper, but I mean, it's probably 6 or 7.
Yeah,
South
yeah.
Carolina could be 3 or 4. I mean, so, and then, you know,
and that's just for TV. That doesn't
right,
even speak
field
to
flying your candidate around on a plane. And the fact that, you know, a couple of days after South Carolina, a whole slew of other states are voting, right? You got, you know, Minnesota, Colorado, Oklahoma, Alabama, Georgia, Texas. And so right. if you have to advertise simultaneously in all those places, by the time you get to Super Tuesday, I mean, just on television, you might have to spend $150 million.
Yeah, which is unbelievable, really, and does speak to, right away, a differentiator if candidates can do that.
Right.
Your candidate could, presumably, because he hasn't developed a base around the country. So I have to ask you the question as to where do you think his head is right now?
Well, you know, I speak to him, you know, with him about it often. You know, it you know, one question that sort of weighs on him, and because he's a serious guy, he wants to make sure that Trump is beaten in 2020. And he wants to be very confident that if he runs, he's running because he's the person who's best able to do that. Now, I think he is, but I'm not the candidate. And if he decides he is, I think the chance of running is much higher. I think if he...
What about age, Jeff? I mean, you know, I know he's an energetic guy. Anybody who watches him on TV can see that. But there are certain immutable laws.
Apparently not, David.
So you're willing to test that. But, I mean, I've been with a candidate in several candidates in presidential races. I know what they exact. I know what the presidency exacts. How much of a consideration is that?
Yeah, look, you know, chronological age is one thing. You know, his biological age has to be, you know, his body has to just be younger. I mean, the guy puts, you know, he puts 23-year-old media people, you know, to shame. They would try to follow him around. I mean, he's the hardest working person I know. He doesn't stop.
You know, so this isn't a concern for you?
Not for me. In terms of his ability to do it, absolutely not. No, if I thought he was going to look, the guy has had an illustrious career. The guy's a United States senator. He was close runner up for president. He got 43%.
Part of having an illustrious career is you've been around a while.
Right, he has been around for a while. So like there's no, if he decides to not run for president, you know, the guy's galvanized a whole generation of young people to get involved in politics. He's changed the debate in this country around issues. I mean, so like he has nothing to prove to me. You know, I think he'd be a great president. I think he could institutionalize a lot of the policies that he has been advocating that have caught fire around the country.
Last time he ran, as you point out, it was he and Hillary basically alone. This time, as we point out, there's going to be a large field. Right. Some of them are right in his lane. Elizabeth Warren, who's already announced that she's going to seriously consider it, which I would take as a kind of very strong signal, and everything she's doing suggests it, that she's going to run. They do share a base on the sort of populist left. She has the additional quality of being a woman, which I think especially in this day and age is a valuable asset and will be in the primaries in 2020. I saw a poll that was just done recently in Iowa of caucus goers, and it had Biden ahead substantially, and then Warren was second and Sanders narrowly behind her. Essentially, they were splitting what would, I think, have been the Sanders vote. So can they both run in the same race and be successful?
Well, and you're right. There was a BuzzFeed story recently about the sort of relationship of, you know, Warren versus Sanders. And I mean, I think you're right to say that it's his lane. I mean, he ran last time when she did not. You know, I think there is some resentment among some of his people that she supported Hillary Clinton and not him. But I do think in a crowded field there is room for both of them. I've seen other research.
Did she support Clinton? I thought she was neutral.
No, she ended up supporting Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. So they're you know, and I've seen other research. And what you have to understand about Iowa and you know, how Bernie Sanders, I think he probably won the popular vote in Iowa, but as you know, they don't report the popular vote, and they will now. They have to now under new Democratic rules, but they didn't then. Is, you know, he changed the nature of the electorate in Iowa. You know, everybody thought there was going to be 135,000 people showing up, and there was 170,000 people. And, you know, in that book Shattered, they talk about it. The Hillary people were shocked that of those new voters, you know, they thought there'd be like 2-1 for Bernie or 60-40, and there were 10-1 for
Bernie.
There's
no one competing for those. There are going to be a lot of, you know, Kamala Harris and perhaps Cory Booker and others who will be all competing for these.
No, that's right. But I think, you know, I think Bernie Sanders has a unique appeal with voters. I really do, particularly the voters that we're talking about, which is, you know, we would call low propensity voters, voters who were less likely to vote. He just has an appeal with those voters that others are not going to
have. I'll tell you one other thing he has. He has one loyal friend in you. And I'm sure that whatever he does, that you will be in the thick of it because your conscience won't allow you to
sell comic books.
Hang around the comic book store while that's all going on. Jeff Weaver, it's great to be with you, and thank you so much for coming to the Institute of Politics.
Thank you, David. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.